little kitten who can't find her mother. A promise is a promise, a man, said Rudy. Don't cry, Babette, I'll bring you back the eaglet. I hope you break your neck, said the miller, then we'll be spared all your visiting. That's what I call a good kick. Now Rudy has gone off, and Babette is sitting there crying. But the miller is singing a song in German. He learned it on their travels. But I'm not going to worry about it. That won't help matters.
But it would look good if you did, said the kitchen cat.
7. The Eagle's Nest. From the mountain path sounded a yodel, so merry and loud, heralding good spirits and undaunted courage. It was Rudy. He was going to see his friend, Vezinand.
You must help me. We'll take Ragli along. I have to capture the eaglet up on the mountain ledge.
How about capturing the dark side of the moon first? That's probably just as easy, said Vezinand. You're certainly in good spirits.
Yes, because I'm thinking about getting married. But in all seriousness, listen here, I need to tell you how matters stand with me.
And soon Vezinand and Ragli learned what Rudy intended.
You're a daring lad, they said, but it's impossible. You'll break your neck.
You won't fall if you think you won't, said Rudy.
At midnight they departed, carrying poles, ladders, and ropes. The path led through thickets and shrubbery, across scree and upward, ever upward in the dark night. Water roared below, water trickled from above, sodden clouds drifted across the sky. The hunters reached the steep rock ledge. It grew darker there. The mountain walls almost met, and only high overhead in the narrow gap did the sky brighten. Close by and below them was a deep abyss with rushing water. All three of them sat still. They wanted to wait for daybreak when the eagle flew out. It had to be shot before they could even think of capturing the eaglet. Rudy squatted down as motionless as if he were part of the rock where he was perched. He held his rifle out, ready to shoot, his eyes fixed on the uppermost cliff where the eagle's nest was hidden under the projecting ledge. The three hunters waited a long time. Then, high overhead, they heard a crackling, whistling sound. A huge, hovering object darkened the sky. Two gun barrels took aim as the black eagle shape flew out of its nest. A shot rang out. For a moment, the outspread wings moved, and then the bird slowly dropped, as if, with its size and wingspan, it might fill the whole ravine and in its fall carry the hunters down with it. The eagle sank into the depths. Tree branches groaned, and shrubs broke under the bird's fall. Then they got busy. Three of the longest ladders were tied together to reach all the way up. They were set on the farthest foothold at the edge of the ravine, but they didn't quite reach. And the cliff face stretched smooth as a wall quite a bit higher, where the nest was hidden in the shelter of the projecting rock. After some discussion, they agreed that there was no choice but to lower down into the ravine two ladders tied together, and then attach them to the three others that were already in place below. With great difficulty they dragged the two ladders up to the top and tied the ropes tight. The ladders were shoved out over the projecting ledge and hung there, swinging freely above the abyss. Rudy was already sitting on the lowest rung. It was an ice-cold morning. Clouds of fog were rising up from the black chasm. Rudy was sitting there like a fly perched on a swaying piece of straw that a nest-building bird had dropped on the edge of a tall factory chimney. But a fly can soar off if the straw comes loose. Rudy could only break his neck. The wind whistled around him, and down in the abyss the racing water roared from the thawing glacier, the Ice Maiden's palace. Now he started the ladder swinging, like a spider trying to grab hold from his long, swaying thread. On the fourth try, when Rudy touched the tip of the ladders that were tied together and positioned below, he caught hold of them and fastened them all together with a strong and steady hand, although they continued to wobble as if on worn hinges. The five long ladders looked like a swaying reed reaching up toward the nest, leaning vertically against the rock face. Now came the most dangerous part, which required climbing like a cat climbs. But that was something Rudy could do. The cat had taught him how.
he didn't notice Vertigo, who strode through the air behind him, stretching out her polyp arms toward him. Now Rudy was standing on the top rung of the ladder and realized that even at this height he was not high enough to see into the nest. Only by using his hands could he reach it. He touched the thick, intertwining branches on the bottom of the nest to see how sturdy they were, and when he had found a thick and solid branch, he swung himself from the ladder up toward the branch and raised his head and chest over the side of the nest. Streaming toward him came a suffocating stench of carrion. Rotting lambs, chamois, and birds lay there, ripped to shreds. Vertigo, who was powerless to touch Rudy, blew the poisonous vapours into his face, trying to daze him. And down below in the gaping black depths of the racing water sat the Ice Maiden herself, with her long, pale green hair, staring with deadly eyes like the barrels of a shotgun.
"Now I'm going to get you!"
In a corner of the eagle's nest, Rudy saw a big, powerful eaglet that could not yet fly. He fixed his eyes on the bird, held on tight with one hand, and with the other flung a snare around the young eagle. It was captured alive, its legs caught in the tightening cord. Rudy tossed the snare, holding the bird over his shoulder, making sure that the bird hung well below him as, with the help of a dangling rope, he held on until the tip of his foot once again reached the top rung of the ladder.
"Hold on! If you don't believe you're going to fall, you won't!"
It was the old rule which he followed, holding on tight as he crawled, certain that he would not fall. And he didn't. Now came the sound of a yodel, so loud and joyous, Rudy was standing on solid ground with his eaglet. 8. More news from the parlour cat.
"Here's what you demanded," said Rudy, as he strode into the miller's house in Bex and set a big basket on the floor and removed the cloth.
Two black-rimmed yellow eyes glared, flashing and wild, ready to scorch and clamp onto whatever they looked at. The short, strong beak opened to bite. The neck was red and down-covered.
"The eaglet!" shouted the miller.
Babette gave a shriek and jumped aside, but could not take her eyes off either Rudy or the eaglet.
"You're not easily scared off," said the miller.
"And you always keep your word," said Rudy. "Each person has his trademark."
"But why didn't you break your neck?" asked the miller.
"Because I was holding on tight," replied Rudy, "and I still am. I'm holding tight to Babette."
"You'll have to wait until she's yours," said the miller, laughing.
And Babette knew that was a good sign.
"Let's take the eaglet out of the basket. What awful glaring eyes it has! How did you manage to capture it?"
Then Rudy had to tell the story, and the miller looked at him with eyes that grew bigger and bigger.
"With your courage and your good fortune, you could support 3 wives," said the miller.
"Thank you, thank you," cried Rudy.
"But you don't have Babette yet," said the miller,
and playfully slapped the young alpine hunter on the shoulder.
"Do you know the latest news at the mill?" the parlour cat asked the kitchen cat. "Rudy has brought us the eaglet and is going to take Babette in exchange. They kissed each other and let her father see them do it. They're as good as engaged. The old man didn't kick. He pulled in his claws, took an afternoon nap, and let those two sit and gush. They have so much to talk about that they won't be finished by Christmas."
And it's true that they didn't finish by Christmas time. The wind whirled the brown leaves, and the snow filled the valley with drifts, as it did on the high peaks. The Ice Maiden sat in her proud palace, which grew bigger in winter. The rock faces were covered with ice, and icicles as thick as arms, as heavy as elephants, in the places where the mountain stream fluttered its veil of water in the summertime. Garlands of fantastic ice crystals shimmered above the snow-powdered spruce. The Ice Maiden rode on the howling wind across the deepest valleys. The blanket of snow spread all the way down to Bex. She could go and see Rudy, who was indoors more often than usual, sitting with Babette. In the summer they would be married. Their friends talked about them so much that their ears burned.
The sun shone, the loveliest alpine rose glowed, the lively, laughing Babette, who was as lovely as the spring that arrived, the spring that made all the birds sing of summer and of their wedding day.
"How those two can sit and hang on to each other," said the parlour cat. "I'm sick and tired of all that meowing."
9. The Ice Maiden. Spring had unfurled in succulent green garland of walnut and chestnut trees that were the most abundant from the bridge at Saint-Maurice to the shores of Lake Geneva along the Rhone, which with tremendous speed came rushing from its source beneath the green glacier, the Ice Palace, where the Ice Maiden lives. From there she let the fierce wind carry her up to the highest snowfields, and in the sharp sunlight she stretched out on the snowdrift cushions. There she sat and fixed her piercing gaze on the deep valley below, where people were busily moving about like ants over a sun-splotched stone.
"Powers of reason, as the children of the sun call you," said the Ice Maiden. "Vermin is what you are. Just one tumbling snowball, and you and your houses and towns would be crushed and obliterated."
And she lifted her proud head higher, and looked with deadly flashing eyes all around and far below. But from the valley came a rumbling sound, the shattering of rocks, human endeavours. Roads and tunnels were being constructed for the railroad.
"They're pretending to be moles," she said. "They're digging passageways. That's why I can hear sounds like gunfire. But when I move my palaces, the roar is louder than crashing thunder."
From the valley, a column of smoke rose up, moving forward like a fluttering veil. It was a drifting plume from the locomotive that was pulling a train along the newly opened railway, an undulating serpent whose joints were one car following another. Swiftly it sped forward.
"They're pretending to be gods down there, those powers of reason," said the Ice Maiden. "But the forces of nature are still in control."
And she laughed, she sang, echoes filled the valley.
"That was an avalanche falling," said the people below.
But the sun's children sang even louder about human intelligence that prevails, that can harness the seas, move mountains, fill valleys, human intelligence which is master of the forces of nature. At that very moment, a party of travellers came across the snowfield where the Ice Maiden sat. They had tied themselves together with ropes to form one great body on the slippery ice surface near the deep crevasses.
"Vermin," she said, "how can you be masters of the forces of nature?"
And she turned away from them to cast a scornful glance at the valley far below where the train was roaring past.
"There they sit, all those ideas. But they're caught in the grip of nature. I can see every one of them. One sits as proud as a king all alone. Over there they're clustered together, and there half of them are asleep. When the steam dragon comes to a halt, they climb out and go on their way. Ideas going out into the world."
And she laughed.
"That was another avalanche," said the people in the valley below.
"It won't reach us," said two people inside the steam dragon. Two souls and one mind, as the saying goes. They were Rudy and Babette, and the miller was with them too.
"As baggage," he said, "I've come along as one of the necessities."
"There they sit, those two," said the Ice Maiden. "Scores of chamois have I crushed. Millions of alpine roses have I broken and shattered with not a root remaining. I obliterate them all. Ideas, powers of reason."
And she laughed.
"Yet another avalanche," they said, down in the valley.
10. Babette's Godmother. Staying in Montreux, one of the nearby cities which, along with Clarens, Vernex, and Crin, forms a garland around the northeastern end of Lake Geneva, were Babette's godmother, the elegant English lady, and her daughters, along with a young relative. They had only recently arrived, but the miller had already paid them a visit, announced Babette's engagement, and told them about Rudy and the eaglet, about his visit to Interlaken, in short, the entire story. It had amused them greatly and favourably disposed them to Rudy and Babette, and to the miller as well. All three of them had now been invited, and so they went. Babette would see her godmother, and her godmother would see Babette. Near the little town of Villeneuve, at the tip of Lake Geneva, was a steamship which in half an hour's journey could reach Vernex, just below Montreux. This is a coast celebrated by poets. Here, under the walnut trees, near the deep blue-green lake, Byron sat and wrote his melodic verse about the prisoner in the gloomy Château de Chillon. There, where Clarens is reflected in the water, along with the weeping willows, Rousseau wandered, dreaming of Héloïse. The Rhone River flows past beneath the towering, snow-capped mountains of the Savoy, and not far from its source in the lake is a little island. In fact, it's so small that from the shore it looks like a boat. It's a rocky crag. 100 years ago, a lady ordered it to be walled with stone, covered with earth, and then had 3 acacia trees planted there that now cast shadows over the whole island. Babette was simply delighted by this little spot. It was her favourite place on the entire voyage. She said they should go there, must go there. Surely it would be incomparably lovely there, she thought. But the steamship continued past and pulled into harbour, as it should, at Vernex. The little group then set off upward between the white sunlit walls that surrounded the vineyards outside the small mountain town of Montreux. There fig trees offered shade in front of the farmhouses, and laurels and cypresses grow in the gardens. Halfway up stood the pension where Babette's godmother was staying. They were warmly received. Her godmother was a large, friendly woman with a round, smiling face. As a child she must have looked much like one of Raphael's cherubs, but now she had the face of an older angel, with silvery white hair curling all around. Her daughters were graceful, elegant, tall, and slender. The young cousin who was staying with them was dressed in white from head to toe, with golden hair and golden whiskers that were so plentiful they could have been divided up among 3 gentlemen. He promptly devoted the utmost attention to little Babette. Lavishly bound books, sheet music, and drawings were spread across the big table. The balcony door stood open to the lovely expanse of lake, which was so sparkling and still that the Savoy Mountains, with their villages, forests, and snowy peaks, were reflected in it upside down. Rudy, who was usually so bold, lively, and undaunted, felt out of his element, as the expression goes. He walked about as if he were treading on peas across a slippery floor. How slowly the time passed! It was like a treadmill. And now they were going out for a stroll. That went just as slowly. Rudy would take 2 paces forward and 1 back to keep in step with the others. Down they went to Chillon, the gloomy old castle on the rocky island, to look at the torture stakes and dungeons, the rusty chains in the rock face, the stone benches for the condemned, the trap doors through which unfortunate prisoners were hurled below to land on iron spikes in the surf. That was what they called pleasurable sights. It was a place of execution, elevated through Byron's song to the world of poetry. Rudy sensed only the execution site. He leaned over the big stone window ledges and looked down into the deep blue-green water and then across to the lonely little island with the 3 acacia trees. That's where he yearned to be, away from all his chattering companions. But Babette was happy. She had enjoyed herself immensely, she later said. The cousin, she thought, quite perfect. "Yes, a perfect gadabout," said Rudy, and that was the first time Rudy had ever said anything that didn't please Babette. The Englishman had given her a little book as a souvenir of Chillon. It was Byron's poem, The Prisoner of Chillon, translated to French so that Babette could read it. "It's all well and good with that book," said Rudy, "but the fine-combed fellow who gave it to you was certainly not to my liking."
"He looked like a flour sack without any flour," said the miller, and laughed at his own wit.
Rudy laughed too, and said that was very well put. 11. The Cousin. A couple of days later, when Rudy paid a call at the mill, he found the young Englishman visiting. Babette had just placed in front of him several poached trout that she had garnished with parsley to make them look even finer. That was quite unnecessary. What did the Englishman want? Why had he come? To be waited on and coddled by Babette? Rudy was jealous, and that amused Babette. It pleased her to see all sides of his heart, both the strong and the weak. Love was still a game, and she was playing with Rudy's whole heart. Yet it should be said that he was her joy, her heart's desire, the best and most splendid in the world. But the gloomier he looked, the more her eyes sparkled. She would gladly have kissed the blonde Englishman with the golden whiskers if it would have made Rudy dash away in fury, because it would show how much he loved her. That wasn't right. Nor was it wise of little Babette, yet she was only 19 years old. She didn't think much about it. She gave even less thought to how her behaviour might be viewed by the young Englishman as merrier and more light-hearted than was proper for the respectable, newly engaged daughter of the miller. At the place where the main road from Bex passes beneath the snow-capped peak, which in the Swiss language is called Les Diablerets, the mill stood quite close to a rushing mountain stream that was pale grey like foaming soapy water. This stream did not drive the mill. The great mill wheel was turned by a smaller stream gushing down the cliff on the other side of the river and through a stone culvert under the road, its force and speed lifting it up to pour into an enclosed wooden basin, a wide flume across the racing river. The flume was filled with so much water that it overflowed, offering a wet, slippery path for anyone who might think of taking this route to reach the mill more quickly. That was exactly what the young man, the Englishman, had decided to do. White-clad, like a mill worker, he climbed along it in the evening, guided by the light that was shining from Babette's room. He had never learned to climb, and he narrowly missed ending up head-first in the stream, but he escaped with wet sleeves and splashed trousers. Drenched and muddy, he made his way to Babette's windows, where he clambered up the old linden tree and there hooted like an owl. It was the only bird he could imitate. Babette heard him and peeked through the thin curtains. But when she saw the white-clad man and realized who he was, her little heart began pounding with fear, but also anger. Hastily she put out the light, made sure that all the window hasps were fastened, and then left him to his hooting and howling. How terrible it would be if Rudy were at the mill! But Rudy was not there. No, it was much worse than that. He was standing right below. Loud and angry words were spoken. A fight was about to ensue, maybe even a murder. Babette opened her window in terror, calling Rudy's name, telling him to leave. She couldn't bear for him to stay, she said. "You can't bear for me to stay?" he exclaimed. "So this was all arranged. You're expecting good friends, better than me. Shame on you, Babette."
"You're despicable," said Babette. "I hate you."
And now she was weeping.
"Go, go."
"I don't deserve this," he said, and he left. His cheeks were on fire. His heart was on fire. Babette threw herself across the bed and wept.
"How I love you, Rudy, and yet you can think so badly of me."
She was angry. Very angry, and that was good for her, because otherwise she would have been terribly sad. But now she could fall asleep, and sleep the refreshing slumber of youth. 12. Evil Forces. Rudy left Bex, walking toward home, heading up into the mountains in the fresh, cool air, where the snow lay, where the Ice Maiden ruled. The leafy trees stood far below, as if they were mere potato plants. The spruce trees and shrubbery became smaller, and alpine roses grew along the snow that lay in scattered patches like linen spread out to bleach. There was a blue gentian growing there, and he crushed it with the butt of his rifle. Higher up, two chamois appeared. Rudy's eyes lit up. His thoughts took flight, but he wasn't close enough for a good shot. He climbed higher, where only scraggly grass grew between the boulders. The chamois walked calmly along the snowfield. He pushed on eagerly as the billowing fog sank down around him, and suddenly he was standing before the sheer rock face. Rain began pouring down. He felt a burning thirst, heat in his head, cold in his limbs. He reached for his hunter's flask, but it was empty. He hadn't given it a thought when he stormed up to the mountains. He had never been ill,
but now he had a sense of what it must be like. He was tired. He felt the urge to throw himself to the ground and sleep, but water was streaming everywhere. He tried to pull himself together, but everything was shimmering strangely before his eyes. Suddenly he saw what he had never seen here before, a low hut, newly built, leaning against the rock face, and in the doorway stood a young girl. He thought she was the schoolmaster's Annette, whom he had once kissed at a dance. But it was not Annette, and yet he had seen her before. Perhaps near Grindelwald, that evening when he headed home from the shooting competition in Interlaken.
"What are you doing here?" he asked.
"I live here," she said. "I'm taking care of my flock."
"Your flock? Where can it graze? There's nothing but snow and rocks here."
"You seem to know all about it," she said, and laughed. "Just beyond and a little below here is a lovely grassy pasture. That's where my goats are. I take good care of them, and I never lose a single one. What's mine is always mine."
"How bold you are," said Rudy.
"You are too," she replied.
"If you have any milk, give me some. I'm unbearably thirsty."
"I have something better than milk," she said, "and I'll give it to you. Yesterday some travellers came past with their guide. They left behind half a bottle of wine, better than any you've ever tasted. They won't be back for it, and I won't drink it, so you can have it."
She brought out the wine, poured it into a wooden bowl, and handed it to Rudy.
"That's good," he said. "I've never tasted wine so warm and so fiery."
And his eyes shone. A liveliness, a glow came over him, as if all his sorrows and worries had evaporated. A sparkling, fresh sensation stirred inside him.
"But you are the schoolmaster's Annette, after all," he exclaimed. "Give me a kiss."
"I will, if you give me the pretty ring you're wearing on your finger."
"My engagement ring?"
"That's the one," said the girl.
And she poured more wine into the bowl, then pressed it to his lips, and he drank. The joy of life coursed through his blood. The whole world was his, he thought. Why should he worry? Everything exists for our pleasure and happiness. The stream of life is the stream of joy. To be caught up in it, to be carried off by it, that is happiness. He looked at the girl, who was Annette, and yet not Annette. Nor was she the Troll Phantom, as he had called the girl he had met near Grindelwald. This girl here on the mountain was as fresh as the new-fallen snow, as flourishing as an alpine rose, and as nimble as a kid. Yet she was created from Adam's rib, as human as Rudy, and he flung his arms around her and gazed into her wondrously clear eyes. It was only for a second, and yet... Yes, explain. Recount, tell us in words. Was it the life of the spirit or of death that filled him? Was he lifted up, or did he sink down into the deep, deadly ice abyss, deeper, ever deeper? He saw ice walls like blue-green glass, bottomless chasms gaped all around, and water dripped, ringing like a glockenspiel, and so crystal clear, gleaming in blue-white flames. The Ice Maiden gave him a kiss that froze right through his brow to his backbone. He screamed in pain, tore himself loose, toppled over, and fell. Everything turned to night before his eyes, but he opened them again. Evil forces had made their play. Gone was the Alpine girl, gone the mysterious hut. Water was running down the bare rock face. Snow lay all around. Rudy was shivering with cold, drenched to the skin, and his ring was gone, the engagement ring that Babette had given him. His rifle lay in the snow at his feet. He picked it up and tried to shoot, but it misfired. Sodden clouds filled the crevasse like solid heaps of snow. Vertigo was sitting there, stalking her powerless prey. And from beneath her in the deep abyss came the sound of a boulder falling, crushing and tearing away everything that tried to break its fall. But at the mill, Babette sat and wept. Rudy had not come to visit for 6 days now. He was the one in the wrong. He was the one who should ask her forgiveness, for she loved him with all her heart. 13. At the miller's house.
"What a terrible ruckus there is with those people," said the parlour cat to the kitchen cat. "Now everything has fallen apart again between Babette and Rudy. She's crying, and he probably hasn't given her another thought."
"I don't like that," said the kitchen cat.
"I don't either," said the parlour cat. "But I'm not going to worry about it. Babette can go ahead and be sweethearts with Red Whiskers, although he hasn't been back here either since he tried to climb onto the roof."
Evil forces make their play both outside of us and within. That's what Rudy had recognized and now pondered. What exactly had happened around him and inside him, high up on the mountain? Was it a vision or a feverish dream? Never before had he experienced fever or illness, but he had gained insight into himself even as he reproached Babette. He thought about the wild chase in his heart, the searing fern that had newly broken loose inside. Could he confess everything to Babette? Every thought which, in that moment of temptation, could have made him act? He had lost her ring, but with its loss she had won him back. Would she confess to him? His heart felt as if it would split in half as he thought of her, so many memories rose up. He saw her before him, as large as life, laughing, a merry child. Many a loving word that she had spoken from the fullness of her heart flew like flashes of sunlight into his breast, and soon there was an entire sun inside him for Babette. Surely she would be able to confess to him. And she must. He went to the mill. There was a confession that began with a kiss and ended with Rudy as the sinner. His great error was in having doubted Babette's faithfulness. It was quite despicable of him. Such suspicion, such ferocity could make them both unhappy. Yes, it could. And that's why Babette held a little sermon for him. It amused her and made her look so lovely. Yet on one point Rudy had been right. Her godmother's relative was a gadabout. She was going to burn the book he gave her, and not keep anything at all that might remind her of him.
"Well, now that's over," said the parlour cat. "Rudy is back, they've come to an understanding, and that's the greatest joy of all, they say."
"Last night," said the kitchen cat, "I heard the rats say that the greatest joy is eating tallow candles and having a good supply of rancid pork. So who should we believe, the rats or the sweethearts?"
"None of them," said the parlour cat. "That's always the surest course."
The greatest joy for Rudy and Babette still lay ahead. The most beautiful of days, as it's called, was in the offing, their wedding day. But the wedding would not take place in the church in Bex, or in the miller's house. Babette's godmother wanted to host the wedding celebration, and the marriage ceremony itself would be held in the beautiful little church in Montreux. The miller insisted that her request be honoured. He alone knew what the godmother had planned for the newlyweds. She was presenting them with a wedding gift that was certainly worth a minor concession. The date was set. The evening before they would travel to Villeneuve, and then in the morning continue by ship, so as to arrive in Montreux in time for the godmother's daughters to help the bride dress.
"I suppose we'll at least have a celebration the day after the wedding here at home," said the parlour cat. "Otherwise I wouldn't give even a meow for the whole thing."
"There's going to be a feast," said the kitchen cat. "Geese have been slaughtered, doves strangled, and a whole deer is hanging on the wall. My teeth itch at the mere sight of it. Tomorrow they begin their journey."
Yes, tomorrow. Tonight Rudy and Babette sat in the mill for the last time as an engaged couple. Outside the Alps glowed, the evening bells chimed, the daughters of the sun sang, "Whatever is best will happen." 14. Visions in the Night. The sun had gone down. The clouds were sinking over the valley of the Rhône between the towering mountains. The wind was blowing from the south, an African wind. Down over the high Alps came a fern that tore the clouds apart, and when the wind vanished, everything was quite still for a moment. The tattered clouds hung in fantastic shapes between the forest-covered slopes above the rushing Rhône River. They hung in shapes that looked like sea creatures from the primeval world, like hovering eagles from the sky and like leaping frogs from the swamp. They sank down to the surging current, they sailed along it, and yet were sailing in the air. The current carried with it a fir tree torn up by its roots, with the water making swirling eddies before it. That was Vertigo, with her sisters, spinning around in the rushing stream. The moon shone on the snowy peaks, on the dark forests and the strange white clouds. Night visions, spirits of the forces of nature. The mountain farmer saw them through his window pane. They were sailing below in hordes before the Ice Maiden. She had come from her glacier palace. She was sitting on the flimsy ship, an uprooted fir tree. The glacier water carried her along the river toward the open lake.
"The wedding guests are arriving," the air and water whistled and sang.
Visions outside, visions within. Babette had a peculiar dream. It seemed to her that she was married to Rudy, and had been for many years. He was now away hunting chamois, but she was at home, and sitting next to her was that young Englishman with the golden whiskers. His eyes were warm, his words exerted a magical power. He held out his hand, and she had to follow him. They left the house, kept going down and down, and Babette felt as if a burden were pressed to her heart, growing heavier and heavier. It was a sin against Rudy, a sin against God. Suddenly she was all alone. Her clothes were ripped by the thorns. Her hair was grey. In great pain she looked upward, and on the mountain crest she spotted Rudy. She stretched out her arms to him, but didn't dare call out or pray, and neither would have done any good, because she soon realized that it was not him at all, merely his hunting jacket and hat hanging from an alpenstock, the kind that hunters set up to fool the chamois. And in the utmost pain Babette lamented,
"Oh, if only I had died on my wedding day, my happiest day! Lord, my God, that would have been merciful, my greatest joy! Then the best would have happened that could possibly happen for Rudy and me. No one knows the future."
And in ungodly grief she threw herself into the deep mountain crevasse. A cord snapped. A funeral dirge sounded. Babette awoke. The dream was over and erased, though she knew that she had dreamed something terrible. She had dreamed about the young Englishman whom she hadn't seen for months, hadn't given a thought. Was he in Montreux? Would she see him at the wedding? A tiny shadow slid across her delicate lips. Her brows knit together, but soon a smile and a sparkle returned to her eyes. The sun was shining so beautifully outside, and tomorrow was their wedding day, hers and Rudy's. He was already in the parlour when she came downstairs, and soon they were off to Villeneuve. Both of them were so happy, and the miller too. He laughed and beamed, in the best of moods. What a good father, an honest soul he was.
"Now we're the masters of the house," said the parlour cat.
15. The Conclusion. It was not yet evening when the three joyous people reached Villeneuve and ate their supper. The miller sat in the armchair with his pipe and took a little nap. The young couple walked arm in arm through the town and out along the road beneath the cliffs, covered with brush, along the deep blue-green lake. Gloomy Chillon, with its grey walls and heavy towers, was reflected in the clear water. The little island, with the three acacias, was even closer, looking like a bouquet on the lake.
"It must be lovely over there," said Babette.
Once again she had the greatest desire to go there, and her wish could be fulfilled at once. A boat floated near the shore. The rope attached to it was easy to untie. There was no one around to ask for permission, so they simply took the boat. Rudy knew how to row. The oars dipped like fish fins into the placid water, which was so supple and yet so strong, supporting like an entire back, swallowing like a whole mouth, gently smiling. Softness itself, and yet with a power terrifying and strong enough to destroy. A foaming wake appeared behind the boat, which in a few minutes carried the pair over to the island where they stepped ashore. There was just enough room for the two of them to dance. Rudy swung Babette around two or three times, and then they sat down on the little bench under the drooping acacias. They gazed into each other's eyes, held each other's hands, and everything around them glittered in the glow of the sinking sun. The spruce forests on the mountains were tinged red-violet, just like flowering heather, and where the trees ended and the rock face emerged, the mountain glowed as if transparent. The clouds in the sky blazed like crimson fire. The whole lake was like a fresh, blushing rose petal. As the shadows climbed up the snow-covered slopes of the Savoy, the mountains turned blue-black, but the highest peak shone like red lava, displaying once again an instant from the creation of the mountains when these glowing masses rose up from the earth's womb, not yet extinguished. It was an alpenglow, the likes of which Rudy and Babette had never seen. The snow-covered Dent du Midi shimmered like the disk of a full moon as it rises on the horizon.
"So much loveliness, so much happiness," they both said.
"The earth has no more to give me," said Rudy. "An evening hour like this is an entire lifetime. How often I felt happy, the way I feel right now, and thought that even if everything should end right here, my life has been so happy. What a blessed world this is. And then the day would end, but another would begin, and I thought that day was even more beautiful. Our Lord is infinitely good, Babette."
"I'm so happy," she said.
"The earth has no more to give me," exclaimed Rudy. And the evening bells rang from the Savoy Mountains, from the Swiss Mountains. Glowing like gold, the blue-black Jura rose up in the west.
"May God grant you all that is most splendid and best," exclaimed Babette.
"And so he will," said Rudy. "Tomorrow it will be mine. Tomorrow you will be all mine, my own lovely little wife."
"The boat!"
cried Babette at the same instant. The boat, which was to carry them back, had come loose and drifted away from the island.
"I'll get it," said Rudy.
He threw off his coat, tore off his boots, jumped into the lake and swam briskly toward the boat. Cold and deep was the clear blue-green ice water from the mountain glacier. Rudy looked down into it, just one brief glance, and he seemed to see a gold ring tumbling, gleaming, sparkling. He thought about his lost engagement ring, and the ring grew bigger, expanding to a glittering circle, and inside of it shone the clear glacier. Infinitely deep chasms gaped all around, and the dripping water rang like a glockenspiel, blazing with pale blue flames. In a mere second he saw what will take us many long words to describe. Young hunters and young girls, men and women who had once sunk into the glacier's crevasses, stood there as large as life with open eyes and smiling lips, and from far below them came the echo of church bells from buried towns. The congregation knelt beneath the church dome. Pieces of ice formed the organ pipes. The mountain stream played organ music. The ice maiden was sitting on the clear, transparent bottom. She rose up toward Rudy and kissed his feet. A deadly chill passed through his limbs, an electric shock, ice and fire. It was impossible to distinguish the difference in that brief touch.
"Mine! Mine!" echoed around him and inside him. "I kissed you when you were little. I kissed you on the lips. Now I'm kissing you on your toe and on your heel. You're all mine."
And he vanished in the clear blue water. Everything fell silent. The church bells stopped ringing. The last notes faded with the glow on the red clouds.
"You're mine!" echoed through the deep. "You're mine!"
echoed on the heights from eternity. How lovely to fly from love to love, from earth to heaven. A chord snapped. A funeral dirge rang out. The icy kiss of death had conquered what was mortal. The prologue had ended before a life's drama could even begin. Discord had dissolved into harmony. Would you call this a sad story? Poor Babette. For her it was the hour of agony. The boat drifted farther and farther away. No one on land knew that the bridal couple had gone to the little island. The evening wore on, the clouds descended, darkness came. Alone, in despair, wailing, she stood there. A mighty storm hovered overhead. Lightning flashed above the Jura Mountains, over Switzerland and over the Savoy. From all sides came flash after flash, thunder after thunder, rolling, one peal after the other, lasting for minutes at a time. The lightning bolts were as bright as the sun. Every single vine could be seen as if it were noontime, and then everything was again pitch dark. The lightning formed ribbons, knots, zigzags striking all around the lake, glittering from all sides, while the crashing thunder grew louder with the echoing roars. On land they pulled the boats up onto shore. Every living thing sought shelter, and then the rain came pouring down.
"I wonder where Rudy and Babette are in this terrible storm," said the miller.
Babette sat, with her hands clasped, with her head bowed to her lap, mute from grieving, from screaming and wailing.
"In the deep water," she said to herself, "deep down as if under the glacier, that's where he lies."
Into her mind came thoughts of what Rudy had told her about his mother's death, about his rescue when he was brought up from the glacier's crevasse as a corpse.
"The Ice Maiden has taken him again."
A lightning bolt flashed, as dazzling as sunlight on white snow. Babette sprang to her feet. The lake rose up suddenly like a gleaming glacier. There stood the Ice Maiden, majestic, pale blue, shimmering, and at her feet lay Rudy's body.
"Mine!"
she cried. And then all around there was darkness and torrents of water.
"How ghastly!" wailed Babette. "But why should he die just as our day of happiness had arrived? Dear God, enlighten me, enlighten my heart. I don't understand your ways. I am lost in your power and wisdom."
And God enlightened her heart. A glimmer of memory, a merciful ray, her dream from the previous night, as large as life, flashed through her mind. She remembered the words she had spoken. Her wish for the best for herself and for Rudy.
Oh, was it the fruit of sin in my heart? Was my dream a future life whose cord had to be cut for my own salvation? How miserable I am!
Wailing, she sat there in the dark night. In the deep silence, she thought she could still hear Rudy's words, the last thing he had said. "The earth has nothing more to give me." His words resounded with the fullness of joy repeated in the flood of grief. A couple of years have passed. The lake smiles, the shores smile, the vines are heavy with grapes. Steamships with fluttering flags are racing past. Pleasure boats with their billowing twin sails fly like white butterflies across the mirrored surface. The railway above Chillon has opened, leading deep into the valley of the Rhône. At every station, strangers disembark. They arrive with their red-bound guidebooks and read about all the remarkable sights they will see. They visit Chillon. They notice out there in the lake the little island with the three acacias, and they read in their book about the bridal couple who, in the year 1856, sailed over there one evening, about the bridegroom's death, and not until the next morning did anyone on shore hear the bride's despairing screams. But the guidebook says nothing about Babette's quiet life with her father. Not at the mill, strangers live there now, but in the beautiful house near the train station, where, from the window on many an evening, she still gazes out across the chestnut trees toward the snowy mountains where Rudy once scampered. In the evening hours she sees the alpenglow. The children of the sun settle down up there and repeat the song about the wanderer whose cloak was torn away by the whirling wind and carried off. It took the mortal husk, but not the man. There is a rosy glow on the mountain snow. There is a rosy glow in every heart in which the thought resides, "May God let the best befall us." But this is not always revealed to us as it was for Babette in her dream.
The Wood Nymph, a tale from the 1867 Paris Exposition. "We're going to the exposition in Paris. Now we're there. What speed, what haste, without any kind of sorcery. We travelled by steam, on ships, and along railways. Our time is the time of fairy tales. We're in the centre of Paris, in a grand hotel. Flowers adorn the stairs all the way to the top. Soft carpets cover the steps. Our room is comfortable, and the balcony door stands open, facing a large square. Down below dwells the springtime, It was brought to Paris, arriving at the same moment we did. It appeared in the form of a big young chestnut tree with delicate newly sprouted leaves. What springtime loveliness it wears compared to the other trees on the square! One of them has passed completely from the ranks of living trees and is lying down, pulled up by its roots and tossed to the ground. In the spot where it once stood, the fresh chestnut tree will be planted and grow. For the moment, the chestnut is still standing upright in the heavy wagon that brought it to Paris this morning from many miles away out in the country. There it stood for years, close to a mighty oak tree. Under it, the blessed old priest often sat, talking and telling stories to the listening children. The young chestnut tree listened too. The wood nymph inside it was still a child, after all. She could remember back to the time when the tree was so small that it reached only a little above the tall blades of grass and ferns. They were then as big as they would ever be, but the tree grew bigger and bigger each year, drinking in the air and sunshine, receiving dew and rain, and inevitably being jostled and shaken by the strong winds. That's all part of growing up. The wood nymph was happy with her life, with the sunshine and the songs of the birds. Yet her greatest joy was in the human voice. She understood their language just as well as she understood the animals. Butterflies, dragonflies, and houseflies, yes, everything that could fly paid a visit, and all of them gossiped. They talked about the village, the vineyards, the forest, the old castle and grounds with its moats and ponds. In the water dwelled living creatures that in their own way could fly from place to place underwater, creatures with knowledge and thoughts. They were so wise that they never said a word. The swallow that had dipped down into the water spoke of the beautiful goldfish, about the fat bream, the plump tenches, and the old algae-covered carp. The swallow gave a very good description, but it's better to see for yourself, it said. Yet how could the wood nymph ever have a look at those creatures? She would have to make do with gazing out across the lovely landscape and sensing all the bustling human activity. How lovely it was! But the loveliest of all was when the old priest stood under the oak and talked about France, about the great deeds of men and women whose names have been spoken with admiration down through the ages. The wood nymph heard about the shepherdess Joan of Arc and about Charlotte Corday. She heard about the ancient times, about the days of Henri IV and Napoleon I, and about cleverness and greatness all the way up to the present. She heard names, each of which has resonated in the hearts of the people. France is the foremost country in the world, the seat of genius, with the font of liberty. The village children listened reverently. The wood nymph did no less. She was a pupil along with all the others. She saw in the shape of the sailing clouds image after image of what she was hearing. The clouds in the sky were her picture book. She felt so happy in beautiful France, and yet she had a feeling that the birds, in fact all the creatures that could fly, were much more blessed than she was. Even the housefly could look around, see far and wide, far beyond the wood nymph's horizon. France was so vast and grand, but she saw only a small patch of it. The land stretched out into the world, with vineyards, forests, and great cities, and Paris was the grandest, the mightiest of all. The birds could fly there, but she never could. Among the village children there was a little girl, so ragged, so poor, but lovely to look at. She was always singing and laughing, plaiting red flowers into her black hair. "Don't go to Paris," said the old priest. "You poor child, don't go there. It will be your ruin." And yet that's where she went. The wood nymph often thought about her. They both shared the same desire and longing for the great city. Spring came, then summer, autumn, winter, a couple of years passed. The wood nymph's tree bore its first chestnut blossoms, and the birds chirped about it in the lovely sunshine. Then a stately coach came along the road carrying an elegant lady. She was driving the beautiful prancing horses herself, while a livery-clad little groom sat in back. The wood nymph recognized her. The old priest recognized her, shook his head, and said sadly, "You went there, and it was your ruin, poor Marie." How can he call her poor? Thought the wood nymph. Oh, what a transformation! She's dressed like a duchess. That's what she became in the City of Enchantment. Oh, if only I were there in all that radiance and splendour. At night the city illuminates the very clouds when I look toward the spot where I know it must be. Yes, the wood nymph looked in that direction every evening, every night. She saw the glittering haze on the horizon. She missed it on the bright moonlit nights. She missed the sailing clouds that showed her images from the city and from history. A child reaches for her picture book. The wood nymph reached for the cloud world, her book of thoughts. For her, the summer warm, cloudless sky was a blank page, and during the past few days she had seen nothing else. Warm summertime had arrived, with sun-hot days and no breeze. Every leaf, every flower seemed in a stupor. The people did too. Then clouds rose up in the very direction where at night the glittering haze proclaimed, "Here is Paris!" The clouds rose, forming an entire landscape of mountains, shooting through the air, out over the whole countryside for as far as the wood nymph could see. The clouds were piled like mighty blue-black boulders, layer upon layer, high in the air. Lightning bolts flashed from them. "They too are God's servants," the old priest had said. And then came a blinding bluish flash, gleaming as if the sun itself had exploded the boulders. Lightning struck, smashing the mighty old oak tree to its roots. Its crown shattered, its trunk shattered. Split apart, it fell, as if spreading out to embrace the messenger of light. No bronze cannons have ever boomed through the air and across the land at the birth of a royal child the way the thunder pealed at the passing of the old oak tree. The rain poured down, a refreshing wind blew. The storm had passed. It felt as solemn as a Sunday. The villagers gathered around the fallen old oak. The old priest spoke words of praise, and a painter sketched the tree itself as a lasting memorial. "Everything passes on," said the wood nymph. "Passes on like the clouds, never to come again." The old priest came no more. The school roof had fallen in. His pulpit was gone. The children came no more, but autumn did return. Winter came, but also spring. And during all these shifting seasons, the wood nymph gazed in the direction where every evening and night on the distant horizon, Paris gleamed like a radiant haze. Out of it flew locomotive after locomotive, one train after another, rushing, roaring, and at all hours. In the evening, at midnight, in the morning, and all day long the trains came, and crowding in and out of them were people from every country on earth. A new wonder of the world had summoned them to Paris. How did this wonder manifest itself? "A magnificent flower of art and industry," they said, "has sprung up from the barren sand of the Champ de Mars. A gigantic sunflower from whose leaves you can learn geography and statistics, acquire the knowledge of a guild master, be uplifted by art and poetry, study the size and greatness of all the countries. A fairy tale flower," others said, "a colourful lotus plant spreading its green leaves out across the sand like velvet carpets that burst forth in early spring. The summer will reveal all its glory. The autumn storms will blow it away, and not a leaf or root will remain."
End of Disc 10.
Next to the École Militaire stretches the Champ de Mars in a time of peace, the field with neither grass nor straw, a patch of sandy steppe cut from the African desert, where Fata Morgana displays her mysterious air castles and hanging gardens. At the Champ de Mars they appeared even more magnificent, more wondrous, for ingenuity had made them real. "A present-day Aladdin's palace is rising up," people said. "Day by day, hour by hour, it unfurls more and more of its rich splendours. The endless halls are resplendent with marble and colours. Here Master Bloodless is moving his steel and iron limbs in the great circular Palais des Machines. Works of art in metal, in stone, in textiles, proclaim the spirit that is stirring in all the countries of the world. Halls of paintings, floral splendour, everything that spirit and hand can create in a craftsman's workshop is on display here. Even ancient relics from old castles and peat bogs have appeared. This great, overwhelming, colourful show has to be diminished, reduced to a toy in order to be reproduced, comprehended, and seen in its entirety. Like a Christmas banquet table, Champ de Mars presented an Aladdin's palace to industry and art, and surrounding it were trinkets from every country, trinkets of greatness. Each nation was given a memento of its homeland. There stood the palace of Egypt, there the caravansary of the desert. The Bedouin on his camel arriving from his land of sun rushed past. There sprawled the Russian stables with magnificent fiery horses from the steppes. The little Danish farmhouse with its thatched roof and its Dannebro flag stood next to Gustav Vasa's house from Dalarna, carved so magnificently from wood. American cabins, English cottages, French pavilions, gazebos, churches, and theatres were wondrously scattered all around, and among them fresh green lawns, clear trickling water, flowering shrubs, rare trees, and hothouses that made you think you were in the tropical forests. Entire rose gardens brought from Damascus were resplendent beneath the rooftops. What colours! What fragrances! Stalactite grottos, artificially constructed, surrounded pools of both fresh and salt water, offering a view of the marine realms. You could stand on the bottom among the fish and polyps. All this, they said, is now presented and on exhibit at Champ de Mars. Across this enormous, richly set banquet table, like a swarm of busy ants, moves the whole crowd of people, on foot or conveyed in small carts, since not every pair of legs can tolerate such an exhausting trek. From early morning until late in the evening they come. Steamship after steamship, packed with people, glides along the Seine. The onslaught of carriages keeps increasing. The crowds of people, both afoot and on horseback, swell constantly. The trams and omnibuses are crammed, stuffed, and bedecked with people. All these currents are moving toward one goal, the Paris Exposition. All the entrances are resplendent with the flag of France, while around the building that houses the Bazaar of Nations, banners flutter from every country. The Palais des Machines hums and buzzes. Melodies chime from the bell towers. Organs play inside the churches. Hoarse nasal songs blend together from the cafes of the East. It's like a kingdom of Babel, a babble of tongues, a wonder of the world. Assuredly, that's the way it was. That's what all the reports said, and who hadn't heard them? The wood nymph knew everything that had been said about the new wonder in the City of Cities. "Fly off, you birds! Fly off to have a look! Then come back and tell me," was the wood nymph's plea. Her longing swelled to a wish, became her life's desire. And then, in the silent, still night, the full moon gleamed, and out of its disk the wood nymph saw a spark fly. It fell, glittering like a shooting star, and in front of the tree, whose branches shook as if pitched by a storm, stood a magnificent, luminous figure. It spoke in tones as soft and strong as the trumpets on Judgment Day that will restore life with a kiss, summoning to judgment. "You will go to the City of Enchantment. There you will take root, sense the rushing currents, the air and sunlight. But your lifetime will be shortened. The number of years you could have expected out here in the open will be reduced to a paltry sum of years. You poor wood nymph, it will be your ruin. Your longing will grow, your craving, your demands become stronger. The tree itself will become a prison for you. You will abandon your husk, abandon your nature, to fly out and mix with the human beings. Then your years will dwindle to half the lifetime of a mayfly, to a single night. The flame of your life will be blown out. The tree's leaves will wither and vanish, never to come again." That was its tune, that was its song, and the light disappeared, but the wood nymph's longing and desire did not. She trembled with anticipation, with the wild fever of intuition. "I'm going to the City of Cities," she rejoiced. "Life is just beginning, billowing like a cloud. No one knows where it will lead." At daybreak, when the moon turned pale and the clouds crimson, the hour of fulfillment arrived. The words of the promise were redeemed. Men appeared with spades and poles. They dug around the roots of the tree, deep down and underneath. A cart drove up, pulled by horses. The tree's roots and the clump of earth that contained them were pulled up and wrapped in reed mats, almost like a warm foot muff. Then the tree was set on the cart and lashed tight. It was off on a journey to Paris. It would remain there and grow in the great city of France, the city of cities. The branches and leaves of the chestnut tree trembled as the cart began to move. The wood nymph trembled with the pleasure of anticipation. Away, away, sounded in every pulse. Away, away, sounded in trembling, hovering words. The wood nymph forgot to say farewell to her home, to the swaying blades of grass, and the innocent chamomile that had looked up to her, as they would to a great lady in the garden of our Lord, a young princess, playing shepherdess out here in the open country. The chestnut tree was on the cart, nodding with its branches to say either, live well, or away, the wood nymph wasn't sure which. She was thinking about, she was dreaming about, all that was so wondrously new and yet so familiar, all that was about to unfold. No child's heart full of innocent joy, no blood of passion, has ever begun a journey to Paris more filled with thoughts. Live well became, away, away. The wheels of the cart turned, what was distant became near, and then was left behind. The countryside changed.